You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
War, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek, The Next Generation. And tonight's episode is The Price. I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And I'm James from London.
And the synopsis for tonight's show is the Enterprise hosts negotiations for possession of the only known stable wormhole. It's the 8th episode of Season 3 of The Next Generation. First aired on November 13th, 1989. It was written by Hannah Louise Shearer and directed by Robert Shearer. Interesting. But it's a different Shearer. They're spelled differently. And besides, that is interesting because this was Shearer Boredom.
Oh, ouch.
Ouch. So, guest stars for tonight's episode include Matt McCoy as Devanani Rawl, that cad, Elizabeth Hoffman as Bhavani with her freaky headgear, Castillo Guerrera as Seth Mendoza, Scott Thompson as Damon Goss, Dan Shore as Dr. Arador, Kevin Peter Hall as Leor, Cole Meany as Miles O'Brien. In voice only, huh? Fascinating. We don't get to see him beam up the... Oh, no, they come directly to the observation lounge, so I guess that would make sense.
Yeah, that's the Ferengi when they come on board.
Yes. So what do we think about this episode? You know, I think you guys are all smart. And the way I've set this up, that you know what I think. What about you, Doc? Goes to show we don't prep for this, huh, do we?
No. This is hard. This is hard because This hasn't worked very well. I don't think this works very well as an episode. And I have to say that I think the things that work least well are the Troy storyline, the Troy kind of like Rao kind of like relationship. Mm. And I'm trying very hard to be not to be dismissive of this just because it happens to be like a woman's relationship. I'm trying my best not just to be misogynistic here and just say, Troy shouldn't have a relationship, blah, 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 blah. But I actually don't think it's very well done. But I don't want to step on anyone's, if people are Troy lovers and they think that this is actually a wonderful relationship, then, well, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think it is. And on top of that, I think the backdrop, the stable wormhole stuff is okay. I think it's a little bit boringy, and I think it's a little bit, it's certainly not as good as last week's episode, and I feel like this falls slightly on its face, to be honest.
Mm. Yeah, I very much could have done without the oily foot massage.
You got an oily foot massage recently, did you, Lou?
No, I didn't, but Troy did. Definitely could have done without that. It just, to me, do you want me to stretch these negotiations out a little bit? I'm sorry, but we only have 45 minutes. Is it my imagination, or does Deanna really have mommy issues? Three communiques from your mother.
Oh, actually, by the way, I quite like the beginning. I thought how it started was fine. I like that, Troy gets home after a day at work and is, doesn't want to reply to her mom and gets frustrated and then is on the verge of arguing with the computer about what is, what is acceptable nutritional guidelines when she asks for ice cream with whipped cream or whatever it happened to be. Mm. And, you know, you could also tell when then, you know, Picard says, hey, Troy, would you like to come over and meet the delegation? She's like, no. And he goes, oh, no, you know, just put something on. And then, you know, he said, look, I'm not really dressed for it. And then said, oh, put something on. Don't worry what it is. And then she doesn't even get changed. Uh-uh. She just walks straight out and turns up in her, you know, in her standard uniform. I thought that was a nice part for Troy.
I guess. But now what? I can't imagine Picard didn't say, Counselor, what was that? I mean, obviously, you know, we've seen many times where someone calls someone else and, you know, the person doesn't have to hit the communicator to acknowledge. So yes, maybe...
Yeah, I noticed that as well.
So maybe, you know, there's a Vox option on the communicator. You know, you can set it to where when someone calls you, your microphone is already hot or that you have to tap to get it.
Yeah. Well, I think she's living dangerously, right? You don't want that to be overheard. You can imagine the other side as Picard's intent forward, and it's like, Picard's a counselor, Troy. Oh, now what? It's not going to come across very well over speakers.
What does that bald bastard want now? Yes, Captain. Counselor. I didn't know you felt that way about me, but we'll talk about that later. Okay, but here's the thing. What is she expecting from the replicator? A real ice cream sundae with real chocolate chips and real... How can the computer even make a real? I mean, you've got to make the ice cream and you have to make the syrup. And so there's no real anything. So that was a useless argument.
What I took away from it was that what was being replicated was effectively the low-fat variety.
Oh.
So maybe it was, you know, all the butter had been taken out and only margarine was put in place. And instead of, you know, instead of the good stuff, they had, you know, some type of, you know, instead of the milk, they had the soy milk and all of the rest of the stuff that's supposed to be good for you.
Okay. Well, you know, I mean, the replicator can make a chicken that looks just as good as the real stuff, tastes just as good as the real stuff, but is made out of energy. And I'll have for some of your replicated bird meat. I think that's coming another day.
It is strange. We have seen multiple occasions of people introduce the replicator to other people, other species, and say, look, it can create whatever you like, and it's all going to be absolutely fantastic, and it's all as good. You won't be able to tell the difference. And as soon as their backs turn, it's like, did you see the sandwich it's tried to replicate? It doesn't even know where to start. And you can imagine, if the replicator can't get a chicken burger right, it's probably not going to get anything that Geordi needs or any kind of medication stuff right either, that Crusher needs. No wonder they never want to synthesize stuff in the replicator if they can't even get chicken right.
Or tomato soup.
Yep. Or, you know, whatever you need to take Scotty off to his jolly happy land for an hour or two before you have to whip out the, it is green alcohol.
Yeah. It is blue. It is green. That was funny. That's, you know, Scotty was in both those episodes. So anyway, Picard wants Deanna to come to 10-4 to meet the delegates who will be bidding for the rights of the Barzan wormhole. And Picard is announcing everyone, and the last one announces himself, and I'm Devanani Rawl. As he, like, starts immediately, you can see the water coming from his mouth, but he unfortunately has a woman on his arm. But he does end up sending her packing. Or his traveling companion is traveling.
Yeah, I think, what did he do? Did he kill her or something? Or send her home? I think one of the, in my mind, one of the shortfalls on this episode is the Rao-Troy interaction. And even right at the beginning when they are introducing them, it's like, hello, counselor, we've got Delegate 1, Delegate 2, Delegate 3. And then, out of nowhere, this, you know, charming fella announces himself, and then the camera moves over and you know, cue the music. And maybe I'm just heartless, but I kind of thought, oh, come on. You know, you should be able to do better than this.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised Riker didn't pounce on that real quick. She's mine. He could have saved himself a little argument later on. Okay. So what do you think of the Barzan funky headgear? I mean, she has those two little pieces at the sides of her mouth. Is that to keep her mouth from opening too far? Or keep her mouth open?
It would be rude to say that's to stop her biting people.
Ah.
I think it was, well, first of all, the correct answer to the question is, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But then the next answer to the question is, she mentions that her planet's like inhospitable and stuff. So I thought it was some type of apparatus that helped her breathe whilst she was in normal territory or something weird like that.
Okay.
A bit like who are the guys?
I'm thinking Mendon was one.
Mendon, yeah.
And I can't think of the species. That'll probably come to us later. Or you'll probably start looking right now. Okay, so the wormhole that they're bidding on seems to be stable and will take them to the Gamma Quadrant, which is very interesting. Now, there has been a discussion about when the Dominion became aware of the Federation. Could have been many thousand years ago, or do you think it's possible that this wormhole allowed them to send a probe to learn more about the Alpha Quadrant?
I don't know. I always thought, I don't think the Dominion at this stage, at least, or even at any stage, I don't think they're kind of like on top of a lot of this stuff. So I never got the impression that they were kind of like this all overseeing kind of knowledgeable set of people. So I just generally do think that we kind of like stumbled across the Dominion when we did.
Well, yeah, obviously. But I mean, I was thinking that there's another possible explanation when they sent out 1,000 changeling babies to, you know, explore the galaxy. Obviously, one probably came back from the... Although, you know, did the female changeling say, you know, you're the first that's ever came back so far to Odo?
Oh, I mean, this is really bad of me. That rings a bell, but also I thought that there was... Odo meets up with the other changeling in Chimera, and he was like, you know, he was an older guy. So,
mm-hmm.
at one point, it rings a bell when you mentioned that Odo was kind of the first back, but then also, I was always interested that Odo was like the baby of the lot as well. So, I don't know. I can't answer that.
But then again, I also think, you know, you can't really believe anything anyone of the Dominion ever says.
No, that's true. Well, one thing that I did think was a bit of a contradiction is that on numerous occasions they mention the appearance of a stable wormhole.
Mm.
And I kind of thought, isn't that a contradiction somewhere? Mm. It's like, oh, out of nowhere, this stable wormhole appeared, and we were pretty sure it's going to stay around. Oh, no, there it goes. It's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Unless this thing had been... It seemed strange that you would have only found out about it now, or it had only appeared now. Both of those would kind of negate this idea that it's a stable wormhole.
Right. It should have been there for a very long time. And this is an interesting one because they actually have clocked this wormhole of when it appears, and you know everybody accumulates in 10 forward to wait for the wormhole to open up, but yet in DS9, you know, we can obviously... We just go right into the wormhole. It just sits there, and the only time you ever see it open is when a ship approaches.
Yeah, I mean, I think that... by the way, I do like the idea of wormholes. I think this is one of the first few times that they mention wormholes. I think that it's also a good jumping-off point, in particular with DS9, to have something that takes you to another side of the world. It's a good mechanism to get out of the straitjacket of the local space that you know well and have seen everything.
Right.
So I like the idea of it, and I also think that, hey, I mean, technically, by the way, there's a bit of real science behind it, so that's always going to get a good thumbs up from me. I think the story is nice, and maybe I was trying to read too much into it. I actually liked the idea of the negotiations and the idea that this particular species, they didn't have much, and this was their quote natural resource, and you could kind of relate it to a modern day story about a poor country discovering oil, and how would they go about selling that and becoming a rich country, and almost the idea of the vultures kind of circling around this to try to exploit this, you know, quote unquote natural resource. I suppose in this case it's not quite the same thing, but I was trying to, you know, look and see if there's like any hidden message or hidden allegory that could be applicable to the real world, but I just didn't think there was one. I thought there was, it was a pretty much open and shut case of, hey, we've got a wormhole, come and do business, and a pretty two, you know, pretty one-dimensional storyline, I'm afraid.
Right. And of course, we find out Devanani Roll is actually a Betazoid who's manipulating everybody. Wow, he was, that he was good at. I gotta tell you, the roundabout way he was manipulating, you know, Leora, the Caldonians, and then finally the Ferengi, and which, by the way, haven't beamed aboard yet because they want a piece of this wormhole. They want a bid too. And, you know, it's pretty arrogant to come in and say, I'll match whatever anyone offers and add the gold on top of it.
I think this episode's the first time we have the proper shift in the Ferengi.
Yes. Right?
Because last time we saw them, they were still kind of menacing, whereas now they are, you know, I really like the performance of the Ferengi in this episode. And I think that by this stage, we're into the S9 Ferengi. The way that they beam aboard, and let me just park the chair issue for a second, but the way that he kind of says, oh, look, I'm going to outbid everyone, and it's like, you know, from the Daemon's perspective, I think he believes he's just taking care of business.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, game, set, and match. And you think, dude, how can you be so delusional? But it's part of their, you know, it's part of the Ferengi characteristics, and I just, I love them. Mm. And the whole issue about the chairs, right? When he he kind of beams aboard and said, you know, oh, you know, where are some chairs? He said, oh, no, excuse me, I'm in charge here. Oh, so you'll get us the chairs? He said, no. He said, oh, okay, we'll get the Klingon servant to get us some chairs. And, I mean, maybe it's not the greatest thing ever written, but I have an affinity for the Ferengi, in particular in this guise, in the capitalists, the corrupt capitalists.
Yeah, well, who gets the chairs? So, okay. All right. Well, aren't you glad that they didn't beam 15 Ferengi aboard? I mean, they just seemed to blind transfer three Ferengi right over to the observation lounge.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, well, you usually only get around three Ferengi or so, right?
Right.
I think the makeup's expensive when you have more.
And for now, they'll eventually we'll get more. But did you notice the tattoo on each of the Ferengi's head?
Yes, but I think that's been there since the start, though. I think that most of the early Ferengi have that. Like, it's the Ferengi insignia kind of thing, the thing that looks like, you know, it's also on their ships and so on. It's like this, the stamp of the crest of the Ferengi Alliance.
I never noticed that in the past Ferengi episodes. I didn't notice that.
So certainly on The Last Outpost, the very first one, where they've got the guy on the screen, he's certainly got one. Like, it's always, as you know, they've been stamped on the forehead by kind of, you know, a little bit of a slightly more modern, kind of like, you know, kanji symbol.
Okay, that's Alliance rules. All right, so Devanani Roll, he visits Deanna for a dinner date, and he hits on her with such precision. I'm almost jealous.
I have big problems with this hair.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to let you say what you have on your notes before I mention, because, I have kind of had a problem with it too, but go on.
But this is, the first thing I should point out is that I'm not a woman. So maybe this is actually extremely well-written and exactly what women want. But if I were to imagine myself as a woman, I would be kind of pressing the alarm buttons as soon as this guy comes in. I think he's far too all over her straight away, and I've, on my notes, I've just got, you know, creepy dude all throughout. And please don't tell me that this thing, like, woos over the, you know.
Oh, my God.
You know, the ladies. That's not what I've been told. But I don't want just to poo-poo this because it's a, you know, it's a relationship with one of the female members of the crew. I don't want to shoot it down for that. I'm shooting it down because I just think that I would actually go after the guy with a cricket bat and get rid of him if I were Troy, because Troy can do much better than this. And I don't see anything in this dude other than a little bit of a slimy, like, used car salesman.
Right.
Anyway, what are your thoughts, Lou?
I kind of thought, you know, it wasn't quite as bad, but it rises to almost the level of sexual assault. I mean, he's got his hands on her quick, and yeah, it was too much, too fast. And you could see the complete uneasiness in her face until she finally just gives him this look of, okay, yeah, I'm here, I'm in.
Yeah, but what look does she give her? Oh yeah, meet me in the bedroom tonight.
Yeah,
I don't think that's appropriate. I think he should have been beaten to death with a stick by Troy. But Troy seems to, for whatever reason, now maybe I would have been more comfortable. That, you know, let's say that Troy did want this relationship. I would have been more comfortable for Troy to go after him rather than to have this guy behave in this way, because I'm probably not articulating very well at all, but I just didn't, you know, I didn't feel comfortable with the way that they showed the, you know, the burgeoning romance.
Okay.
Maybe that.
All right. This. So, Picard says it would take nearly a century at warp 9 to cover the distance of the wormhole to the Gamma Quadrant. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, a quadrant's a big space anyway, right? So even if you're, I remember that Voyager was around 70 years away, and they've probably got more than warp 9, so, you know, 100 years or so is perfectly reasonable. And he's also probably, you know, simplifying the calculation in his head as well.
That could be true. That could be.
So, you know, by the time it's 70 years, it's he might as well be 100.
That's true. Yeah, I guess the caretaker really could have had 25,000 more light years he could have done, but he didn't. Okay, let's see. So obviously we learned that the wormhole is not stable on the other side. I'm kind of surprised that the Federation didn't do a few more tests. It sounds like it only sent one probe in.
Well, had they sent a probe prior to this? I didn't catch that. I thought that the first time anyone had gone through the wormhole was, because the people that owned the wormhole didn't have manned shuttle, right? I would have thought, let's just assume that you want to sell this thing. I think the first thing is that you're going to want to decide, you're going to want to properly research what you've got. So the first thing you probably get is a scientific crew in to have a good look around, to measure things properly and to make sure that it looks good and it's you know, it's up to the Trade Description Act. And if, you know, you don't let the guys wanting to buy it come around, poke around, and then realize that it's going to trap two of them on the other side of the galaxy for the rest of their lives. To me, if I were the Ferengi, I'd sue these guys for incompetence.
Yeah, but actually, I think that was covered. If I'm thinking that she admittedly says we do not have the resources to explain this and to administer this, but you do, and I think that's why they just wanted to. They got their gold. They found gold, and they want to sell it to people. And I think that's why.
It's a bit like, you know, having a real big, you know, like a gold mine at the end of the garden, and saying, "Hey, we've got this massive gold mine at the end of the garden. Go and have a look. We don't think it's safe. Be careful." And the first thing you hear is a Ferengi like fall into his death. Splat!
Splat!
Well, we warned you.
Yeah, right. So, but you know, as you know, Cole and Erador do end up coming back to us in the future in Voyager. So. Which, if you know, someday we ever go on and do a Voyager podcast,
what? Lou, this is mission creep. This is extending.
Yeah, you signed on for TNG, and so far you've been I'm trying to wrangle you into DS9, and now I'm just bringing up Voyager. I ain't gonna say anything about Enterprise yet. So let's see here. This is fascinating. I love this part, and I don't understand why it doesn't get brought up again. The Ferengi can draw some of their own blood, put it in their hand, and disable anyone they shake hands with. Can you imagine what Quark could have done with that?
But the reason why it's never brought up again, it's just the, you know, it's just the hijinks that they need for this particular episode to get stuff done.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, we haven't spoken about the Mendoza character, who is the guy that gets taken out by this. But, you know, almost as soon as the episode started, and this is with, you know, without having actually seen it, you realize that, you know, there are going to be tense negotiations between these three people, and then you go, well, so one way or another, Riker is going to end up in negotiations, because that's the way the writers want to play it. And it happens that, yeah, they come up with this idea of have a very bad shake hands with a Ferengi, and, you know, the key man on the Federation side ends up in sick bay for the rest of the week. I'm surprised that there isn't any provision, right? Because let's just assume that, you know, is there really only one guy on the negotiating team for the Federation?
Apparently.
There's just one guy? And because if there is just one guy, it's very easy to kill or bribe or you know, do stuff to.
Well,
you would have thought a diplomat or an ambassador would have staff and more negotiators around.
Well, they even covered that when they said all parties agreed that only one.
Oh, yes, you're right.
Only one person, so. But still.
Didn't they try to claim, because things are so complicated, we're only going to have one dude?
Right.
Which seemed counterintuitive.
Right, he should still have a staff on hand. And when he goes out, one of them should be able to take over. But what I don't get is why the Ferengi would have thought, just because Mendoza was out of the picture, that the Federation would just withdraw. That's some pretty cheesy moves. You know, the Federation's top negotiator taken out by a mysterious ailment. Any ideas, number one? With the Ferengi around? So they were quick to blame the Ferengi. What about Devanani Rawl?
I have to say, I think one of the things I like the most about the Ferengi is their fake fury. You know, whenever they get accused of something and they think, this is outrageous, and, you know, what, it's completely true, but they've got this way, and it's not just in this episode, it's in others, about being extremely angry about accused of cheating when they have cheated.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of like, I do like it.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a little, there are shades of it in this episode.
So, all right. So, Mr. Mendoza's out. So, the Federation's going to send in... Now, I hope I feel like I missed some things, but the Federation's going to send in their own probe, and the Ferengi will not believe what they say, so they send their own probe in, too. But they find out that they are not, in fact, in the Gamma Quadrant. They are actually in the Delta Quadrant.
Let me ask you a question about the shuttle pod, Lou.
Yeah.
Could either Geordi or Data actually stand up in that shuttle pod?
No.
Because it's a pretty tight squeeze, right?
That was cramped.
I always, whenever I see that, you know, the shuttle pod, I don't know how long it lasts, whether it goes all into like season four, whether they get rid of it. But it's so tiny. It's, you know, there's actually a little bit of a nice line where... It's a little bit out of nowhere, but when Geordi says, oh, you know, I don't want to be stuck in the Gamma Quadrant for the rest of my life, and then Data kind of mentions that on the bright side, he'll have him to talk to.
Mm.
But even if you think about them being stuck there for more than like 20 minutes, it doesn't look like there's any space for anything. You can't stand up, you can't walk around, you can't, you know, you can't relieve yourself. It's a really weird designed ship.
It is. I often wondered, how do they decide what type of shuttle to take? Because I think it wasn't Q who, when Q flings him to the Delta Quadrant and meets the Borg in season two. I mean, it looks like Picard's shuttle was all pimped out a little better than that. There was a lot more room. So how do they decide what to take? And I would have probably said, you know, if these guys are stuck, if they accidentally get stuck there, they may want a better type shuttle. So at least hit warp 9 and start coming back. Data would make it.
Yeah, it's strange. I think it's a valid question. Why do you, when do you take the big car and when do you take the tiny car?
Yeah, really. Yeah.
But you know, you're going to the other side of the world, and also you're going through a wormhole. Which, I mean, in this episode, they have a bit of a nice effect as you're going through. But you probably would have wanted to be in the larger ship. You know, it seems to be more stable. So I don't know. It is a, you know, I assume in the real world, it's just that they had a model, and then it took them a while to build the bigger model and the better model, and they have the, obviously the sets. So then, and it took them a while to build the bigger sets.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. In the past episode, they had a bigger model.
No, you are right. In Q-Who, they did. And also in Samaritan Snare. I can only assume that one was being, you know, that set was busy this week.
I got it. Okay.
I mean, I have to say, I think that the shuttles, all shuttles are absolutely dreadful in my mind until you get to the runabout.
Oh, absolutely.
And the runabout is exactly the is exactly what a shuttle should be and should always have been. And I've never understood, you know, when they actually made that click and went, oh, we'll have these runabouts on the space station. The Enterprise should just have had runabouts, and Voyager should have had runabouts. And it's exactly the proper proportion, and also the sets made. It's a great little, you know, it's a great little place to be able to do your thing in. It looks like a right size for a shuttle. And all of these shuttles you get in TNG, and in particular the early ones, to me just makes no sense.
Yeah. And then I remember, complete tangent here, but there's an episode of Enterprise where they find this probe or this spaceship. They bring it aboard, and then when they go inside, they find out that it's like unlimited space inside this thing.
I believe that's Harbinger, but don't quote me on that.
Yeah.
But I know what you mean, yeah.
Because then I was thinking, you know, it's amazing because the Delta Flyer also looks like it's very much bigger inside than it looks on the outside. But I guess that's the same with all ships in Star Trek. I mean, they all look smaller than they appear on the inside.
And I think you're right with the Delta Flyer in particular. I think it's because of the it has the very large windows that makes you think it's, that would immediately in your mind tie them up to what the windows are, what you would imagine they are in the cockpit. So I think I think that's a good call. I think the Delta Flyer is bigger on the inside than on the outside.
Yeah, because they can go outside the main bridge, and then, you know, you also have another cargo bay area, I suppose. So, and then Tom made that with his own hands. That okay. Anyway,
is it own sweat and blood?
That's right. Yes. Okay. So, let's see here, Deanna. She's pretty easy, ain't she? I mean, on the first date that they meet each other. You know, they're going to be late for dinner because, well, they have some amorous activities to do. Is she really that easy?
I'm not going to go there because I don't want to get in trouble on this. I just don't buy the relationship, and I think it's a bit, it's frustrating, right, how this is written. And not only is it that, you know, it's kind of completely head over heels, but by the end of the episode, which you only imagine is like a couple of hours later, these guys are bickering, and not only do they have the confrontation at the end when they kind of fall out, but also the second to last discussion they have when once Deanna knows about his, you know, his Betazoid like spidey senses, it's a very cold kind of atmosphere already. So if you're telling me that within like a 48-hour window they met, he came over and started rubbing up against her, and then they went to bed, had a bit of a foot massage, she was absolutely head over heels, and then she's kind of got upset with him and then ultimately betrays him, I just don't see how that's realistic.
Yeah.
On a ship being powered by antimatter, I don't see that as realistic.
Okay. So we go back to the Delta Quadrant, and Data says that they're 200 light years away from where they were supposed to be in the Gamma Quadrant. And I was thinking, really, 200 light years is all between the Delta and the Gamma? So obviously they must have been right on the border of each.
Yeah, they all share borders, right? Or at least
yeah,
the ones that are next to each other share borders. So they can always be as close as you need them to be.
Okay. And as I alluded to last week, and the aerobics room. Those suits were quite revealing. That's pretty much all I'm going to say. But I'll tell you, I paid quite a bit of attention to that workout. Ferengi hitting on a woman. What do you think of that?
Oh, in Ten Forward?
Yeah.
I like the way that everyone kind of completely brushes him off. And then I like it that there's a bit when... So there's a bit where you see the end of one of the engagements and then you see like the beginning of the new one. And the way that he's kind of starts it up, it's like, hey! he's got a big smile on his face and he's got half of his teeth missing. And it's, it's always good stuff. And I like the Ferengi deserved to be knocked back.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, she just shot him down and he just turns over and goes to the next one and carries on. So he's trying to be a salesman. But Rawl gets the Caldonians to withdraw from the negotiations, and instead they enter an agreement with the Chrysalians. And I thought, what's a Chrysalian? Alien Chrysalian.
It's like it's a cross between a croissant and an alien.
Oh, I see. That makes sense. Or what's that thing that you're gonna send me someday that I haven't crumpet?
Crumpet. Yeah, it's halfway between a crumpet and an alien.
That's right. Alien crumpet.
I have to say, I thought that Rawl's argument to get the Chrysalians out, it was basically, hey, dude, it's a lot of paperwork, eh? And mm-hmm. Yeah, tell me about it. Oh, do you know what? I'm going to go home. I'm not going to discuss it with anyone. I'm sick and tired about paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. It didn't take a lot to knock them out.
Mm-mm, no, it didn't. Yeah, can you imagine the administration work that's going to be needed to take you? I must admit, I have felt a little trepidation. Yeah, of course you have. I know that. And, you know, and of course, obviously, this whole thing at the end where they're going to go with the Chrysalians instead, I thought, wait, why wasn't why wouldn't she have the Federation? Why would she meet with Devanani without the other delegates? But actually, now that I think about it, they just stayed behind in the conference room after
after the red alert was called. Yeah,
right. So that's probably why. And that was so silly for me. What? What? I was going to blow it up. I don't know what you're talking about.
He said there was no tension. I was tense. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So Data and LaForge decide to get the hell out of there, but the Ferengi, you know, they try to get the Ferengi to follow, but they refuse and find themselves locked in the Delta Quadrant, never to be seen or heard by humans again.
Live long and prosper.
No. But they do eventually come back, and like I said, I love the way they come back. I happen to like False Prophets myself, but we'll have to wait till we get there, huh?
Yeah, we will. I have to say, I do like it. The Ferengi are so wonderfully arrogant and completely sure of themselves. And the way that one of them is sitting there, I don't know whether it's the doctor or it's the other guy, and he says, you know, there is the wormhole, exactly where I expected it to be. And then it shoots off into the distance, and you see this, you see his broken face going, as it disappears, is wonderful.
Yeah. Actually, cold. Sorry about that. Actually, I was playing with Spock here. actually, Cold, it was a non-speaking role. The reason why I looked that up is I thought, you know, it's the same. It looks like the same guy who plays Erador. What about Cole? And it turns out it actually is a different guy who comes in for False Prophets because it was a non-speaking role. So, I'm looking forward to seeing that again. That'd be a nice one to watch tonight. False Prophets. Okay, so there's more scenes with Devanani and Troy, but really, who cares? So Devanani works his magic on Riker. Did you think maybe he almost got to Riker? I see, we're going back. You see, we've already discussed the final, and now I'm going back to when he tries to fake Riker out.
No, I don't think he gets close to Riker at all. I think Riker's well in control of a lot of this. I don't necessarily think he should be, but he's written that way. So, you know, Riker's always on top. And I think that when basically Royal comes over to Riker and goes, "Hey, me and Troy, hey, Troy's pretty good, you know, and you don't have her anymore, and I do, and you know, we're gonna get up to stuff tonight." I actually think that's a quite nice, quite nice exchange, and and Riker's mature enough, and he's grown up, and he's not upset about things, considering that it was only 2 years ago, right, when he got upset about her wanting to go off, and he got forced married, in Haven, and he was like a little baby, whereas at least now he's grown up and he's mature, and so I quite like that. I actually have it down as that I think the Ron and Riker interactions are good, both in the negotiation when they have a bit of back and forth, and also when they are talking about Troy. Although, I mean, to make sure that I stay on the right side of any women out there, I appreciate that women are not an object that should be owned by a man.
Right.
Well, and they do talk a little close to that, I think.
Yeah. You know, and it's funny because I thought I saw a different take on the Riker-Rawl thing. It looked like, Riker was all up in Rawl's crawl there until he brought out Deanna. And it seemed like once he brought out Deanna, we are kind of alike, we're kind of related, Deanna. We both love Deanna. And it just seemed like at that point, Riker's face turns and he starts to become very, I don't know, it just seemed like Rawl could sense that he had him. And then all of a sudden, on a drop of a dime, Riker's expression turns like, that's the first bad play I've seen you make. So I thought maybe he was... Rawl had him for a while, but then he just kept talking. I think had he left it with the Deanna thing, but he talked himself out of it, and that's when Riker comes back and he just slices him apart.
No, I think there certainly is there is a change when he tries to bring in Deanna.
Right. Okay. Yeah, so the Ferengi fires a missile at the wormhole. And again, we're going back to when, but I'm sorry, I don't know how my notes got out of order like that, but yeah, they fire a wormhole because it all set up with Devon Onni. The Ferengi Goss is willing to destroy the wormhole. He was willing to destroy his own pod, but didn't he call it casualties of war?
I think he was, that's right. I think he was. I think a lot of this is highly irrational, right?
Yeah.
At this stage, he was. I think he was kind of waving the when he was firing the missile or photon torpedo, whatever it would have been. I think that it wasn't that he was ever going to do any damage, but if it happened to be the case that the shuttle appeared at the right time, there could have been a bit of a bad accident.
Yeah, I
think it was always a long shot how Picard was portraying it. And as a result, I think he just like rebuffed him with a bit too much, too much of a macho statement, which is, first casualty of war.
Yeah. Well, here's another continuity error. And I think I understand where my notes were trying to go, and I think I was doing one sentence, stopped, and then went into another sentence. But basically, the Ferengi is going to fire, he fires a missile at the wormhole thinking he's going to destroy it, which obviously he knows it can't happen, but it might destroy the pods, and that's a casualty of war. But the thing that bothered me is Deanna jumps up, says, "Captain, he's lying. He doesn't mean what he says." How do you know that, since Betazoids can't read Ferengi?
They can't not read Ferengi yet. So that hasn't appeared yet.
Oh, you're telling me that in the beginning? Okay, that's why.
So I believe it's Menage Troy.
Yes.
Where that is like, that's made clear.
Yes.
So up until that point, it's so you can always square it right by this just being a hunch based on instead of Troy being an empath, just having proper training. But whenever, you know, whenever people try to use that excuse and said, "Oh, yeah, she wasn't talking it from an empathic perspective. She was just looking at her own training and just happened to believe that." That always gets dismissed as what? Proper training? No. Troy does nothing other than just read people's minds, and that she does badly as well.
You know, since she is a lieutenant commander, obviously she must have went through the academy. I wonder how that would have went. Okay.
I would have thought like the psych test would have been quite easy.
Oh yeah, I suppose. I'm just thinking it's a pretty
straight through it.
It's a pretty physical, rigorous thing, though. I'm having a hard time watching Deanna do, you know, sit-ups and push-ups and crunches and and not going back to her dorm every night and eating chocolate ice cream.
She seemed to be flexible enough for in this episode, at least.
Yeah, that's true. I guess. Okay. So Devanani comes to the bridge and announces to the world that the Cressalians have won the rights to the Barzan wormhole. Oh, and, you know, the Ferengi, you can have free access in perpetuity for Ferengi escorts. What exactly is that? Does that mean the Ferengi's going to be their convoy or something? I didn't quite understand. What was the plan with the Ferengi?
I thought it was something along the lines of that you can use this as much as you like, as long as you will be our, you know, we will enter into a negotiation to determine what, you know, what shippers we would like to use for stuff.
See,
so I think it's saying, hey, Ferengi, you know, you can be a UPS of the new world, but and you can use it on the side for your own stuff as well if you want to.
There we go. That's kind of what I thought. You know, you be my courier. The Cressalians will have cargo that needs to go to places. You will do that, and for that, you could use a wormhole as you see fit. But then Deanna busts in and says, I think, Premier Bhavani, there's something you should know, and you could... I mean, Devanani's head almost, he may need chiropractic help because his head immediately turns over. He knows what's going to happen, and, you know, she gives away the secret. He's a Betazoid, which is why he is able to manipulate everybody. But you know what I'm interested in is when Data and LaForge come back and say it's a dry well, Captain, completely useless. When they were back in the conference room, you know, and talking about this fight, definitely about your wormhole. Man, I don't know about you, but I don't think this is good. Do you think they signed some kind of contract? Because, I mean, obviously at this point, we don't see anything signed. So he could have said to Drywell, well, Cressalians are no longer interested.
You're giving the impression that everything has been delivered and everything has been signed and there's no... You know, there's nothing even as much as a, you know, due diligence clause that allows you to take, you know, a couple of minutes to ascertain that all of the, you know, all of everything that you've said in paper is correct. So, yeah, I completely agree. I think that in the real world, you would have probably just walked away at that point after having found, you know, the goods are not up to description. Because I assume they didn't just decide to sell... You know, hey, you get to use this space. Currently, there's a wormhole in it. We think it's okay. Good luck. I would have thought they would have been a little bit more professional than that.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, so it's a dry well, and now Devin and I's got some splaining to do.
I didn't think it was... When they said, oh, it's a dry well, completely useless. I wouldn't want to be around here. Completely useless. Did you hear that? Useless. I thought they were rubbing it in somewhat. And I can think of a couple of good reasons to want to have a wormhole, even if it isn't stable, right? It's a fairly decent random holiday generator. Just pop through it and...
No.
Who knows where you're going to get to.
That's the problem. Yeah, it'd sure be fun to see where you get to. The problem is, on the other side, I got the impression that not only is it not stable to a quadrant, it's not stable to a... whatever it's called, inside the quadrant, to this location. So it's not going to end up on, 25th and Dodge Street. It's, next time it comes around to this location, it's at 40th and Dodge, and then 70th. And there's no way to be able to tell when you're going to be able to go back. So I think it'd be a terrible idea to use that.
No, sure. However, I'm certain that if you were to give people a one-way ticket to a wonderful, potentially wonderful place, I'm sure there are a couple of nut jobs that would take that opportunity even now.
Like the Hansons. Yeah. Mr. and Mrs. Hanson and poor Annika. For some reason, I would have left Annika home. I don't know.
In kindergarten that day.
Yeah, right. So anyway, one last scene with Devanani and Troy. Thank God. Come with me, Deanna. No way, sucker. And that pretty much is the end of this episode.
Did anyone ever think that Deanna would actually leave and head off on a wonderful adventure with this dude?
No, I was pretty confident they were fine. Well, then I guess, unless you have anything more to discuss about it, we should go on in.
Yep, go ahead.
It's now time to give our final thoughts and ratings on this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. So, Doc, you didn't have your script, but I'm going to let you go first.
Okay, sure. Now, I just really think that this episode is rather kind of like meh. It doesn't feel like it does anything particularly well. I think that the B storyline of the wormhole it has some good things in it. There's a little bit of decent humor that I always like as well with the Ferengi, and I think that with a stronger script, this could have been a decent story. There's enough of a B storyline, or at least the overarching kind of like a setting in terms of the wormhole and stuff. That's good, and you could have put a decent story through it, or have that play as a backdrop to another kind of character piece. I just think that the character piece they chose this time, which is a pretty lame Troy relationship episode, I just don't think really worked at all. I don't think I'm generous enough to push this up to a 3. I think this is like a 2 out of 5. I think it's a pretty much a meh episode of Trek, and I think that this is one of the one of the missteps so far, at least in season 3.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, I think I'm not a Troy hater. I would have liked Troy to have had a very well written, rounded, understandable relationship with a charismatic and handsome guy that comes onto the ship one week, but I just don't think it's here.
Mm-hmm.
So how about you, Lou?
What was your rating?
It's 2 out of 5, I'm afraid.
2 out of 5. Okay. We have one more episode that borderlines good and bad, and I think it goes to good after this one. I'm talking about the Vengeance Factor. And then we start really getting into some episodes that are good. So bear with it. It's not really a good episode, like you said. I wondered if maybe the Dominion got wind of us from this wormhole, but really it makes no sense since the other side is unstable and bouncing around. There's no way that they could have gotten a probe in and out, although the Federation did. They got a probe into the Gamma Quadrant and they got it back out, which is why they were so confident that, hey, everything's on the up and up, but they didn't send a second one. It's only stable on the Federation side, but who knows where it would appear. So... the good outcome of this episode is that we do meet up with the two Ferengi again in the future. I like the episode, and I'm looking forward to that. I can't give it a 1. It's not that bad, I guess. There are some moments with the computer and the chocolate sundae and the... Now what? I do kind of like her sassiness. The idea of the bidding for the wormhole, it sounds okay. It's just that damn Devanani Troy... angle. I wish they would have had more Ferengi time. If they had more Ferengi time, that probably would have made this episode a little bit better. But as it stands, I agree with you 100%. It's a 2 at best.
Yeah, I think that's a we are in agreement this week. It's been a while since when was the last time we were in agreement? We're going to be in agreement a lot coming up. I can sense that.
We've been doing pretty good, actually. out of the 8 episodes that we've done, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 have been the same number.
Ah, excellent.
So, except for last week, my 3.75 out of your 4. So that's probably, for all nuts and bolts, the same thing. But there's only 2 episodes that I was we were 0.5 off from each other. So, okay.
And I'm always higher than you, right? Is that not the case?
Yeah, you know something you have been, where we have been different. Yes, you have been higher by 0.5 and 0.25. So, yeah, you've been 0.5, at least 0.25 to 0.5 higher than me.
That's because I'm an ignorant fool that doesn't have a critical bone in his body.
Okay. Also, hey, I've been meaning to... I'm going to bring this up on the show. I like this, in fact. Today, while I was waiting to pick up my daughter, I was reading some Twitter that I got a couple messages, and it says on your Twitter profile that you're willing to do people's math homework.
I will. I will absolutely do people's math homework.
She has an issue with math. She's just in pre-algebra. And James, my God, you know, it's been...
Such thing as pre-algebra?
Well, apparently there is. I mean, I even took
On the Enterprise, you learn calculus when you're like 6.
Right, absolutely. But, you know, they're more advanced than we are. But the thing is, I look at these math problems like I'm a monkey doing a math problem. And, it's got, I don't know, it's got 3x, you know, plus 4 equals the Pac-Man symbol with... I don't know how to describe it, and it has been so long since I've done this that it's just out of my brain. So I think what we need to do is set up some math time with the doctor and my daughter Alexa.
Hey, and if that's not a valid podcast, I don't know what is.
Absolutely. Anybody, if you need math help, just write, get with TNG Rewatch on Twitter, and he'll just send him the math problem question, and he will respond on Twitter, right?
I will. I absolutely will. I've never had anyone send anything my way.
I'm going to send one to you just for the fun of it. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I will find it very difficult. This is the thing. If someone throws down a challenge, and every now and again, by the way, there's always a story in the newspaper in the UK, and they'll say like, hey, are you cleverer than a 10-year-old? And they'll give you a ridiculous kind of quiz-like question they give to children in China about mental arithmetic, and you're expected to sit there and see if you can work it out. And whenever one of these appears at work in particular, at home, people will throw down the gauntlet and they'll say, hey, James, look, there's another problem. You enjoy these, don't you? Yeah, sure. So I'll happily take maths questions over Twitter.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah, that'd be fun to do. Yeah, someday, I just kind of wish I could be a fly on the wall in your office just to see what it is you do. I mean, me, I sit in a room, I watch cameras for shoplifters. It's pretty mundane and rudimentary, but, I mean, for you, I would just love to see what it is you do. Just because, obviously, we're never going to understand it, and all we see on the Big Bang Theory is them walking around this university trying to have sex with people. So, I don't think that's what's happening at your job, that I know of, at least.
No, it's not. But I spend my entire day coding. It's not exciting. Actually, I haven't said that. No, it is exciting. But I still spend all my day coding.
Well, obviously, hopefully you're well paid for what you do. If, you didn't get a doctorate for nothing.
Not well enough.
What? No, well, of course not. Of course
not. Not well enough. Never well enough.
So who got the doctorate first?
You mean as in my wife or myself?
Yeah.
No, I've had mine for like 8 years now.
Ah, okay.
And my wife only got it a couple of, a year ago.
Come on, honey, you can do it.
Yeah. I mean, the flip side of that, of course, is that my wife's the one that got the job first. I was still a student when she was actually earning money.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. Anyway. All right. Well, you might as well go ahead and take us out of this show.
Thank you for joining us this week. Join us again next week as we review episode 9 of season 3, which is The Vengeance Factor.
with the lady who played Beulah Ballbreaker.
Apparently that is true.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska. Are you saying you actually looked up that movie since last week?
I have not yet.
No, I don't think you would. No point in doing it. So good night, everyone.
Good night.
All right, and now we're going to go into forum feedbacks. And this week, we are going to do two to catch us up. And they are going to be the survivors and who watches the watchers. Watching the Mentakans. Let's start the survivors.
I'm starting with Data Logan. He starts with, most tidal forces are made just by the celestial body relatively moving around the Earth. Any effect of the celestial body getting closer and further away is minimal compared to the relative angles involved. Earth would have tides even if it didn't have a moon, because the sun causes tides by itself. Of course, the effect of the moon causes the even larger tides, because the relative difference in gravitational force of the moon is higher because it is so much closer. And when the sun and the moon work together, they make even higher tides than either working alone. That's why tides are generally higher around new moon or full moon. Yeah. Tides caused by more than one orbiting celestial body result in two tides each day. But when you have an interplay between multiple celestial bodies, which even the Earth has with both the moon and the sun, then tides become more complicated and possibly more often. So yes, with three moons, they can become very complicated and frequent throughout a day.
Oh, okay. Got it.
Okay. Surprised that Lou didn't know the phrase by all means, but cool to lead James to come up with a good reason for the Enterprise Chutes and Ladders game.
Well,
what? I don't remember any of this.
I don't. Yeah, by all means. What I think, Data, that we're talking about is I don't use by all means. So when I ask my boss, hey, do you want me to take a look at this piece of video to see something? And he's not going to say, well, by all means. He'll just say yes or no. So I'm just saying that that's not a phrase that I use in any day life. And as far as I did ask the three moons thing. Rana's three furthest moons or something like that. And I said, and the question was, well, three moons, boy, they must have a lot of tides. And since that's what the moon does for us. And so obviously Data's explaining the whole idea of the celestial body. So I wonder what this guy does. I don't know if we asked him that question, but he seems very intelligent. So he must know something I certainly don't. Okay.
In terms of the moons.
Yeah.
Okay, let me tell you something. I have no memory of this at all. When Data Logan mentions about things becoming much more complicated when you have more than two bodies in play, there's actually a problem in maths or maths stroke mechanics, whatever you want to call the thing, which is that whenever you have two bodies, and by bodies we're talking about things that have mass, mm-hmm. so Earth, the Sun, or something like that. If you only have two of them, you can very easily work out what the equations of motion are, which basically will tell you what. You always know the equations of motion, but you can actually solve the equations of motions, which means that given where you are now, you can work out where you're going to be at any point in the future, which means you can generally plot things like us going around the Sun, and you can plot the effect of tides and stuff like that. As soon as you introduce another body, so you become a three-body problem, you are not able to solve that. And when you go more and more, you get into this horrendous situation where you have all these bad knock-on effects where you have this unpredictability introduced by having these multiple kind of bodies. And it is very true that if you throw two moons around the sun, or two moons around the Earth, or multiple suns or something like that, the path that we would take around orbiting that body wouldn't be like a nice ellipse. It would just be completely all over the place, like a kind of a crazy thing. I'm pretty sure on the internet you can find these things that work out what the path is going to be, but it's very very sensitive to your initial conditions, and it really isn't like an elegant us going around the sun in an elliptical fashion. So not only would your tides be completely screwed up, but all your seasons would be screwed up, and and you know, probably night and day as well, as you spin around and you kind of have more axes of freedom. Anyway, I probably should stop that. That's the worst tangent I think I've ever taken.
No. I think people have said in the past they love it when you school us.
So go online, people, and search for the N-body problem. It's not solved in the general case.
Okay, well, that's fine. But is it true? Am I right that I've read somewhere that the Earth seems to be getting closer to the sun by like 15 feet every 10,000 years or something?
No, I don't think so. Now, and here's the... We do get closer to the sun, and we kind of go in a little bit and then out a little bit and then in a little bit and out a little bit, in a bit. So we're kind of stuck in this territory where things that what you'd like to believe or what you kind of get the impression of if you just think about it naively is that we're circling the sun and we've been pulled into the sun. And eventually we're going to kind of be pulled right into the middle and we can't escape this kind of, you know, this circling the drain kind of thing.
Right.
But that's actually not what is happening. Because of the way that we are being pulled in and the way that we orbit, we are actually in a stable position whereby it would take energy for us to be pushed towards the sun, and it would take energy for us to be pulled away from the sun. And unless someone comes along and introduces an outside energy into our system, we're pretty much going to stay in this kind of stable orbit. Now, that's not to say that, I mean, by the way, what I've said there is true under, you know, Newtonian mechanics, and it is the case of what we're looking at for the foreseeable future until the sun explodes. So don't worry about us falling into the sun. But if we did get hit by something like a comet, the orbit could be perturbed and we could fall into the sun after that. But where we stand at the moment, we're safe from a gravity potential perspective.
Good, good.
Shut up, James.
Good. That makes me feel better now. But the first thing I find out when we find out we're spiraling towards the sun is I'm going to call you up and say, screw you, you were wrong. Anyway, okay. So Kieran says, great call from Lou almost off the bat. The crystalline entity is a terrific example of devastation of this planet. It's wiped out everything, but hasn't scooped it up. So it's not the Borg. I don't know if we examine the devastation of Omicron Theta enough to make the link here, though, as I only remember them discussing that's the crystalline entity does in the later episode, Silicon Avatar. So maybe that's why I've never made the connection until Lou mentioned it. And while I'm dishing out praise, I thought it was an excellent point about Troy from James as well. Taking her out explicitly and not just pretending she's useless is something they really didn't do enough, and the character of Troy suffers because of it, at least in this episode, and also in The Loss. Troy is being taken out is a good plot point that stops them from finding out the truth immediately. That was a good one. I must admit, though, the music sounded something I'd hear on an ice cream van. In fact, maybe that's why she's being driven mad. She was craving a double nougat. That's fascinating. But I don't think anybody, I don't know, maybe we'll get to the rest of these comments, but nobody brought the fact that I actually came out with Motley Crue, No Tears. So I'm surprised nobody mentioned that. But I don't know. Have you heard that yet? That episode? I don't know. Have you listened to it?
No, I'm behind. I'm afraid I'm behind.
Oh, Scarface. I actually put Scarface in there, and there are so many beeps in there where I had to put in the bloop, 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 that, you know, imagine what the unedited version would have been like running through her head. So, anyway, I thought you were right when explaining why the actors were younger in their characters than their characters. I've always thought that everyone ages slower or at least better in the future. That might even be the case now. How I'll look in my 80s isn't how my grandparents looked when they were in their 80s. Clean food, clothes to eat, and fresh water. What? I never noticed. I only went back to listen after you mentioned it. Yeah, I'm crazy that way. Okay, to my favorite aspect of this episode, you guys doing the podcast.
That's not written anywhere.
Oh, sorry. But he meant to say it. He says, good tea. Nice house. That was one of my favorite, all-time favorite lines in Star Trek. It's delivered so brilliantly by Michael Dorn. And just the image of Worf drinking from a nice little cup in a lovely house as if he's some kind of at some kind of tea party is fantastic. I can only imagine Worf doesn't tell any of his Klingon friends or family about this aspect of his life. You know, Martok, once I was in a house drinking tea and you what? Anyway, nor would he tell them of the rest of the day he had, of course. I felt sorry for him, actually. There wasn't anything on his scanners. It was all Kevin's doing. I agree that Kevin's story about how they survived doesn't add up. The "we were pacifists, so they left us alone" argument never seemed quite right to me either, given no one asked about any of the other pacifists on the planet. Surely they didn't just assume everyone else fought and only these two didn't. But then again, that's just one of the holes in this story that should have been flagged up. Of course, maybe it wasn't a plot hole. Looking at one of the untouched patches of grass on the entire planet reminds me of the 1940s map of Europe, where the entire continent is controlled by Nazi Germany.
Ooh.
Apart from Switzerland, right in the center of it. When I was at school, I could never figure out why the Nazis didn't just take that as well. I suck at history. Ultimately, the story comes down to how tragic a character Kevin is. In his anger, he went for the nuclear option. He didn't need to wipe out all Hostnach, but he did. And it was because he was angry. At this point, not only does the Federation have no law to fit his crime, they don't have any way to administer the punishment, even if they did. What are they going to do? Execute him? Lock him up? There's nothing they could have done, even if they had something to do. The guy is truly frightening. Do you think maybe could he have brought the Hostnach back to life? I mean, obviously he didn't, but could he have? I mean, I'm surprised nobody said, well, if you have the power to take him out, can you bring him back?
Well, he didn't have the power to bring his wife back, right?
Right.
So he only had a facsimile of his wife, and he effectively lived in a fantasy land. So I would imagine not. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that he doesn't have that power, and it's just, you know, it's you're going to have to just, he's going to have to live with what he's done. So I didn't think he had that power. It is a bit weird, right? When you do give people like absolute power, it's very hard for you to, to ring fence and set up what the rules of engagement are. Because you're right, you know, if he does have absolute power over everyone that's alive, then perhaps beyond that doesn't seem that unrealistic.
Well, I think if the Federation, which he is a member of, by the way, I think the Federation wanted to prosecute him and jail him or, you know, confine him, he probably would have went along with it because he actually believes he deserves it. You know, that you don't understand the scope of my crime. Well, he now acknowledges that he committed a crime. It's tearing him apart. And he probably would go along with whatever punishment he was given. So anyway, he goes on to say, and yet he isn't, because you could tell this wasn't in his nature. I can quite believe he is a pacifist, but he loved his wife and he let his anger get the better of him. Because of that, I don't think he does get away with anything. He has to live with his own morals and acknowledge of what he's done. As someone who is a pacifist and someone who actually lost his wife because of that belief, he has to live with that. Live with what he's done, knowing that he did, and it still didn't bring back his wife. For all he can fake that, he still knows that's fake. It's a double whammy because he's done it earlier rather than being a pacifist. He would have saved her. Yeah. I mean, I would have think he would have saved her. So, is it right to be a pacifist? This episode suggests not, but only if you time it right. I'm not sure how that fits. This is probably one of those morality issues that I don't think is black and white. I probably class myself as a pacifist, but then again, I don't think I wouldn't fight back if I was pushed into that position. Kevin could have protected this colony with the power he has. And to be fair to him, he did try and confuse Ahusnak as he did the Enterprise. But surely there would have been other things he could have tried between confuse them and kills them. Kills them all. Did I do that right? We don't know enough about Kevin's power to know either way. I'm not sure I would class this as genocide, but certainly not on the scale we're used to anyway. If this is genocide, then everyone who has been convicted of that in the past has merely committed attempted genocide. They've actually tried to wipe out entire groups of people and failed. Kevin didn't actually try and do it, he actually succeeded. So why would you not class that as genocide then, if he actually succeeded? Although I love the Worf bits in this episode, I'm not much of a fan of the rest of it. It always seems rather unresolved, and the mystery of how Kevin and Rashaan survived has too many holes that no one questions, even though they're questioning it in other ways. I'd like to have known more about Kevin and the race he comes from, but we leave that little unresolved as well. Who were the Daud, and how could they have dealt with the crimes that Kevin had committed? Picard never even considered it. So overall, some nice ideas, but I'll give this episode a disappointing 2 out of 5. And I gave it a 3.5 and you gave it a 4. So obviously, Kieran doesn't quite agree with us. Okay, so we have a new new one.
We have a new poster. I don't think this person has ever posted, not to us. And Endicore comes in. And actually, first of all, hey, it's always good to get new people posting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do we have like a little like intro song for this dude? maybe we should have like a nice little clip to introduce the new people when they post.
That's an interesting idea there.
A little bit of a celebratory pause.
Mm-hmm.
So, hi, Lou and James. After listening to most of the previous episodes of the Delta Quadrant, the Gamma Quadrant, previously in the Alpha Quadrant, the Lou Trek Show, Ten Forward, and the Battle Bridge, I have finally caught up to the point where I may have to wait for the new episodes to be released. Now, that's some commitment, right?
I would say
that must
so.
Be like 600 episodes there.
I would say so, yeah. He must have a job like me where I can spend most of the day doing podcasts. That is until here in a little bit, I have a problem. IT is shutting off all USBs. So I'm not sure how I'm going to be able to listen to podcasts at work anymore without the use of an iPod or some kind of MP3 device. So that sucks, but go on.
It's a shame I couldn't get caught up a season sooner, because season 2 of TNG has a lot of my favorite Trek episodes. It was especially refreshing after listening to reviews of the final Voyager seasons to go all the way back to the early seasons of TNG and see the creative origins of many Trek elements that are later taken for granted or even become cliches. For example, if you take the adaptive weapon system from the Arsenal of Freedom, the Bynars Collective Consciousness from 1100-1001, the mind-controlling bugs and the alien queen from Conspiracy, and the nanobots from Evolution, stir well and cook for 7 seasons in one movie, you get the Borg as we know them today. Now that's obviously very true.
Ah.
This episode is also noteworthy for the opposite reason. This is one of the last godlike beings which were commonly encountered in TOS to be introduced into Trek lore. The only supernatural beings that get introduced after this that I can recall are wormhole aliens in DS9. Except for this one episode, TNG and Voyager restricted themselves to visits from the Q. I think this is a good thing, because in TNG, which will try to rationalize the existence of Dr. Crusher's granny ghost in some pseudo-scientific terms, super powerful beings that are innately powerful rather than powerful due to some super advanced technology stick out like a sore thumb.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I have to say, I know where he's coming from, he or she is coming from this, and I know that, of course, in TOS, there was a lot of these, superhuman beings, like, you know, whether it's Apollo or whether it's, you know, the Squire of Gothos and stuff, and I think they have their place in Trek, to be honest. And if you do look at what you do have in Next Generation, I know we have this guy who's kind of godlike, but you do also have Q. And Q is, it's very hard not to consider Q as powerful as any of those other people introduced in TOS. Mm-hmm. I just think that Q kind of plays it, he plays it in a lesser, well, in the less 1960s kind of way, and less, I don't know, I actually think that, you know, although I'm all in favor of a lot of the science in Trek, I do have a soft spot where every now and again you come across an alien that's a super being, and whether or not ultimately they are there through technology or whether they are inherently just just super powerful. I suppose, I mean, the caretaker, right, was she a godlike character, or was she only kind of marginally so?
Well, he's kind of like an overseer of a species.
But I thought they had like superhuman abilities.
Well, he was able to draw ships from another quadrant. I mean, that's pretty powerful.
But was that technology based or like?
Yeah. What did it? Him or the station he created?
Anyway, okay. Sorry, I'm getting off on a tangent. Let me get back to the feedback. This is a major reason why this episode does not work for me. So after me. Kevin's powers appear to be magical in nature and are very poorly defined. He is able to locate and eliminate every single Huznuk in the galaxy and create complex illusion in an attempt to fool the Enterprise, but is unable to observe the Enterprise returning to the planet, which doesn't require anything more complicated than a telescope. And for that being, and for a being with an immortal life's worth of experience, both his deceptions to chase the Enterprise away are so inept that the Enterprise can't help but stay to investigate the mystery of the alien ship's erratic behavior. The whole plot somewhat reminded me of the much better later season episode Clues. Actually, Clues is a great episode.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, would we pick up people in a? Okay, no, I'm not gonna get caught in on the godlike aliens. Maybe that's a topic for another day. The rest of Kevin's character doesn't make much sense either. As an immortal being living under the skies in a universe of mortals, he should have been well accustomed to feelings of loss. Has he really avoided all personal contact with everyone before suddenly madly falling in love with Rishon? Also, for someone claiming to be a pacifist, he has no qualms about destroying a completely innocent person's mind. Seems that's a loophole that he could have used on attacking the Huznuk. Actually, yeah. That's some point that we didn't pick up on. It's like I'm a pacifist, and if you question me, I'm gonna come and stab you in the back.
What's a song in your head?
Yeah. If this episode was attempting to make a point about pacifism, then unfortunately it went over my head. Actually, I'm not convinced it necessarily did. I think it's more of I think it liked to raise questions rather than had any kind of philosophy underpinning it, in my opinion. Anyway, sorry, I'm tangenting too much.
It's all right.
The mystery plot was has little rewatch value. While the actions of the alien spacecraft were extremely suspicious, I can't figure out how that allowed Picard to jump to the conclusion that Rishon Uxbridge was not real. Neither can I bring myself to care about the Huznuk, who were never mentioned before, were already wiped out of existence before they were first introduced, and have never been referenced again. And at the end of this episode, when Picard learns that Kevin is responsible for genocide on a galactic scale, Troy is suffering and learns that he chose not to protect the colony, although it was well within his means to do so. Picard acts more resigned and apathetic than anything. This is not season one or two, Picard, I know. The only thing saving this episode are the high production values of season three TNG and the fantastic acting of everyone on the main cast and guest stars, as well as the Worf subplot, which helps me bring this episode to a rating of 3 out of 5.
Okay.
So I was actually expecting a lower score given the chatter there. But yeah, I think that's all reasonable there. Thank you for posting.
Yeah.
And post again.
Yeah, thank you, Endicor. Good to have new people. So hopefully we'll see you in the future. So we'll end this one with saying from Colin saying, I have to agree with Mr. McDuff. Lou hit the nail on the head when he said it reminded him of the entity, crystalline entity, that is. The Borg would have scooped the colony up and not laid waste to it. All them valuable drones going to waste. This is an episode I love, and I enjoy the way it unfolds. You did a great job dissecting it bit by bit, just like the Borg. It does make me smile when they quote the power of the ship's weapons. At the time, I guess that I would have sounded that would have sounded impressive. But now, with technology moving on, only the second mention of the new improved power output makes you think, ooh. It's a bit like a later episode where they attack the Enterprise with lasers. Picard is amused by that fact. It's nice to see amazingly powerful being not making life hell for one race or another in his attempt to hide from what he has done by living a dream world was referencing its nice angle. Patrick Stewart's little facial gestures as he works it all out are brilliantly sublime and show what a great actor he is. I would give this a 4 for sure. All right. And I don't think, you know, we didn't get a forum feedback from Ben, but I'm sure he would have given this a 5.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay, so that was the Survivors. So I guess we can now go on into Who Watches the Watchers? And guess who starts out this one? You're right.
Is it me with Kieran McDuff?
No, I'll do it, but you're right. It's Kieran McDuff. He says, I know this is supposed to be one of the better episodes, but it's another one of those that never really holds my interest long enough. There's too much about it I just find weird. Like, why does Palmer seem to jump out of the duck blind? It's like he's been watching Lazarus in the alternative factor and wanted to try his own luck at the best man's fall. And why proto-Vulcans? I never understood this bit of the episode at all. The Romulans being related to the Vulcans I can understand, but there's never any real explanation for the link between Vulcans and Mentakans. I think what they're saying, he says it never made any difference either. They could literally have been any species at all, and the story would have been the same. I think what they're doing is drawing references because they're so analytical. They're so
logical.
Logical. I think that's the reason why they're saying proto. And Doc, what would proto mean? Is that kind of similar to
before? So, like, it would have been early. Consider this early Vulcan.
There you go. So I think, you know, they're drawing references as they were like Vulcans of the past. So there you go. But never mind the episode. The podcast was far more interesting. I love the long discussions that the three of you had. The what happens next aspect of the episode is probably the most interest part. At one end, you could have religious wars, as Lou suggested. It's quite possible that the legend of the Picard grows arms and legs, whether those who witnessed it want it or not. And the longer that goes on, the more the myths behind will take root. But then, again, it may not. You could be right that they simply move on. You need to go back to the planet a few years later and see for yourselves. It actually reminds me of one of the Iotians from A Piece of the Action. They were massively affected by the book they found about mobsters 100 years earlier, and that impacted across their society. McCoy then left his communicator. I would love to have gone back again in another 100 years to see the planet in the 24th century. Maybe they were suddenly running the whole place like something out of Starfleet. I know that book, Worlds of the Federation, certainly suggested that was the case, but of course that's non-canon. Going back to the concept of the duck blind, I agree. It made a lot more sense in the insurrection with the cloaked suits, so you could actually hear what happens. I'm not entirely sure that fits with the Treaty of the Algeron, though. I thought the Treaty of Algeron was simply the Romulan treaty.
It's one that prevents us developing, prevents the Federation developing cloaking technology.
There you go. I get it. Maybe the gem had Maybe the Jem'Hadar having personal cloaks means it's fine to develop similar technology. Or maybe the Treaty of Algeron had to be re-examined after the Jem'Hadar came on the scene in the first place. Or maybe it was re-examined after the incident with the Pegasus was revealed to all. That's quite a bit down the road. But I imagine that the Treaty of Algeron says that we're not going to develop cloaked ships. I doubt it says anything about cloaked people. Then again, it's not real, so we don't know. The other conversation I really liked on this podcast was the one about the relevancy of the Prime Directive. In my opinion, it's a good thing and seems to stem out of the Vulcans' first contact principles about not going to Earth because we're too primitive until we develop warp drive. I always thought there was an element of logic to that. Until you develop warp capabilities, you're pretty much confined to your own solar system, and so you really can't be... So you can't really impact on anyone else out there. Once you can, then other species can reveal themselves. It certainly makes sense to learn what you can about the species before that time, though, without impacting on their society, so that you're ready when they do reach that achievement. Of course, there's no guarantee how they'll react. The Mentakans are quite primitive, but despite that, the reaction to the news that they're not alone was quite reserved and logical. Maybe that's their proto-Vulcan aspect after all. But imagine a species turning up on Earth with superior technology tomorrow. How would we react? Religions would be trying to find a way to fit them into their dogma. Governments would be considering the threats the superior firepower might pose to their countries. And regular people would range between being excited and curious to freaking out and drinking the Kool-Aid. Certainly, when you factor in sharing technology as another aspect of it, or not sharing, as a case usually is, then it makes sense. Has a culture developed enough to the point if you give them all this technology, they won't blow themselves up with it? I'm not entirely convinced that the human race has reached that point yet, so I wouldn't want another species showing up and doing all that. That's where the Prime Directive comes in. It's a strict rule. Even though the reality is that some species may be able to handle it earlier, while others may not be able to handle it even to that point. It's a bit like rules on alcohol. You can't drink until you're 21. Even though you might be able to handle it when you're 18, while your friend might still be an idiot on one bottle at 23. What's the drinking age there in England?
Well, actually, so this is... There is no drinking age, by the way.
Yes, there is.
No, there's not. There's age before which you can buy alcohol.
Okay.
So I know that's slightly splitting hairs, and I'm pretty sure that...
No.
Actually, I think that you're not allowed... If you're given alcohol when you're like a minor, I'm sure you can be done for a... your parents will be taken to court on the grounds of child abuse kind of stuff. But anyway, you can buy at 18.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it's 18. It might even be younger.
Wow.
But certainly 18.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, you know, if you're sitting in your dining room, you're having a nice family dinner, and you give your 15, 16-year-old a little wine, I suppose that shouldn't be a big deal. But unfortunately over here, it is. You just can't do it. Contributing to the delinquency of a minor. So, but unfortunately, you know, the stories you hear are the parents that give a bunch of booze to the kids and let them have a party with it, and then one of them dies, and that's when all hell breaks loose. So, another good discussion was on the embedded communicator idea and the privacy issues with it. I didn't realize Kirk had one in the motion picture novelization, but it makes some sense for flag officers. I can imagine there would be privacy issues with it recording everything and being of similar thinking to Lou. Riker was the first thing that came to my mind as well. You can imagine the discussions about privacy in the 24th century being something similar as to what we now have about our calls and activities online being recorded by the NSA. At least in Starfleet, it might be about their safety, or a useful way to keep the line open on away missions like this. As for the point about how Kirk would have dealt with the situation as opposed to Picard, I'm not sure Kirk would have gone down the gods route. I always felt Kirk liked a speech as much as Picard, if not more so. Only Picard says it quicker. This was a perfect opportunity to do that. Shatner would have definitely chewed the scenery more, though. And maybe he'd have avoided being shot by the arrow. But then Kirk's speeches were great for destroying computers and all sorts of things like that. So maybe it wouldn't have needed to be shot by the arrow. Overall, I give this episode a 3 out of 5. There's lots to discuss out of it from which I enjoy. But I definitely spent more time enjoying the discussions than the episode itself. Well, that's pretty cool. Thank you. Hey, look who's back. I haven't heard from Mark for a while.
Okay, sorry. Let me just... you asked me about drinking age. Mm-hmm. And I'm afraid I didn't look it up. So in the UK, you can buy alcohol and you can drink in pubs over the age of 18. Mm. If you're 16 or 17, you can have alcohol bought for you. And you can drink in pubs as long as you are also eating and you're being supervised by an adult. And then the other age, the one that I was kind of being slightly facetious about, you're allowed to drink when you're 5. So you're allowed to be served alcohol from 5 upwards.
In your own home, I assume.
In your own home. So you can't go to the pub, but you can have alcohol in your own place. So the clause where you get, where you're effectively the parents get caught is that, you know, is... You can be prosecuted if you're trying to serve alcohol to a four-year-old or a 5-year-old.
Wow. Anything
above that, it's you don't get caught by the quote unquote just it being alcohol, but it then obviously enters into other welfare kind of conditions.
Right.
So it's not just UK, right? It's also if you go to France, there's always, I mean, traditionally at least, it's also portrayed as a very much an atmosphere of whereby you will drink wine as part of the meal.
Wow.
And although it's alcoholic, it's not considered to be a... There's not this divide between it being an adult drink and a child's drink. It's just you'd have watered-down alcohol with your meal. Mm. And it's just culturally what you'd do.
Yeah. Do you drink wine?
No, I'm not a big drinker.
I don't drink at all. Not ever. Not at all. I don't like the taste. The only time I've ever had alcohol was by accident when I went to the casino and asked for a hot chocolate and wanted a little peppermint with it, and they put peppermint schnapps in. It's the only time I've ever drank alcohol. I just have no desire to, and it just akikaka.
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 Okay, so Mark, so obviously Mark Zampa back online, and actually this is one of his favorite episodes, as he mentions. So Mark replies, anyone who's listened to me on past podcasts will know that this is one of my favorite episodes, and I was due to guest for this one, but holidays got in the way, alas. I acknowledge some of the dumb things in this episode, such as Palmer throwing himself out of the duck blind, and the concept of the duck blind itself, which did seem to be rather remote from the Mintaken village. The concept of proto-Vulcans was, I admit, a little bit off, but they had to go cheap on the makeup, I guess. Shooting outdoors at Vasquez Rocks pushed the budget up for this episode. The scene with Nuria in the observation lounge is fantastic, and I like Picard's explanation of humans once lived in huts, and over time they built starships, and all accompanied by some great music, which nobody in the podcast mentioned.
Mm.
Fantastic performances from the guest stars too. Absolute tip-top. Not many people would agree with me, but this is a definite 5-star episode and an episode I always go back to. It's probably the Star Trek episode I've watched most.
Hmm. You know, you mentioned some music, and I guess, you know, really, we don't ever analyze the music. Although, I'll be honest, in The Defector, it's going to be some pretty big bullet points for me is the music in the beginning. So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting that we should do that.
I know it's now too late, but The Enemy had some decent music in it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it did.
It had a decent score that kind of kept the suspense going during the whole show.
Right. Okay, so Simon, Funky Psy 1701 says, I like this
One second. Who recently welcomed a little baby son into the world a couple of weeks back.
Oh, nice.
So he's just become a dad for the first time, and obviously, should we send that best wishes to Simon and his wife, Laura, I believe it is, who they welcomed a little baby called James.
All right. Well, James, how nice. Did you take that, or did you have anything to do with that? A little bribe heading his way?
No. No. It's just a... It's a solid name that stands alone.
Yeah, absolutely. But you don't like to be called Jim. That's the most amazing part of this. Because you don't know how much I'd love to say, damn it, Jim. You don't understand. But anyway, we'll have Simon on for The Hunted here in, three episodes, I believe.
Well, we hope.
Yeah, that's true. I do need to send out emails to let these guys know when we're going to be recording again.
Well, it's not just that. Obviously, I've had a little one drop in over the last couple of months. And given that this is their first child, I think it's perfectly within his prerogative to perhaps be busy that day.
Yeah.
We'll see how things go, of course.
Absolutely. Okay. So, Funky Psy 1701 says, I like this episode so much, I'm giving it a rewatch now. This episode mentioned the duck blind and does so insurrection. I've always wondered, what is the difference between using a holodeck technology to hide yourself and using a cloaking device? The Romulans don't allow the use of cloaking technology, but they would allow us to hide ourselves just because we use a different technology. The results are the same. The atheist in him likes Picard's refusal to allow religion to be created around him. I'm not sure how many other Starfleet captains would go to such lengths, but this is not just the captain. Troy's line about understanding what God wants also amuses me. Some good prime directive discussions this week. Not sure I completely agree with the time travel angle that was mentioned, but still interesting. Could you refresh me on the time travel angle? Oh, it's been so long since we recorded that, Simon. I don't remember what you're talking about.
That's a terrible thing to say.
It is, but it's true. I'm sorry.
I think that wasn't this the discussion that we had about whether or not people are currently watching us by having come back from the future? Did we even have that discussion? it's a really weird world that I live in where that possibly was a discussion I either had with you or I had some with someone else.
Well, that's because I may have Alzheimer's. It's the reason why I don't understand it. Okay.
And hot on the heels from last week, we also have another post from Indicore. So two posts in 2 weeks. That's great. Mm. So great discussion about this episode. You touched on a lot of the major points. I find this episode unintentionally funny in several places. Palmer's self-defenestration, the disguised Troy and Riker bluntly introducing themselves as Troy and Riker, and Benner's suggestion that Picard pretend to be God, to name a few. I can't help but imagine Picard dressing up like Zeus with an obviously fake white beard and all, holding a bolt of lightning in his hand. Seriously, though, why did Benner, the expert anthropologist, even suggest this plan to Picard? Shouldn't he have known to adhere to the Prime Directive even more so than Picard, or did he seep through his ethics class back at university? Not that I find Picard's solution any better. It's almost like channeling Janeway in this episode with his commitment to a policy of 100% honesty. Yet just two episodes ago, he was telling Data that excessive honesty can be disastrous. Luckily, the Mintarkans are so open-minded of strange visitors and new ideas that they can readily accept or even understand the concept of space travel and extra Mintarkans. Very good. Very good. Mm. My hat is tipped to you, sir, coming into their world and spying on them. I can understand the limitations of a single 40-minute TV episode, but everything in the plot is just set up so conveniently to get the group hug in the final scene that it all becomes rather a little absurd. It lacked the perfect timing of the scientist's death. Actually, I do think that's perfect timing of the death is an issue. I don't know if I mentioned that or I just thought that I mentioned that, but that is a valid point.
Mm.
I also agree with Lou when he said that Picard kept digging himself further into a hole until the walls collapsed in on him. The Mintarkans might have been dissuaded from believing in gods, but now Picard gave them direct proof that aliens were visiting their world and spying on them. Now they would have constantly wondered whether or not the aliens were hiding behind every rock face or behind every tree, or flying overhead, constantly watching them working, sleeping, bathing, running legal gambling operations in their basement, engaging in plain old basic sex, etc.
Whoa.
That's not something the Mintarkans would really would have needed to worry about if they created the Mintaka and the NSA. Really, the moral of this story should have been that when you've dug yourself into a hole, the best thing you can do is stop digging. Otherwise, you'll end up with an arrow in your chest and having to rely on the incompetent Dr. Crusher to save your life. Maybe it's the plot. Maybe it's because the plot does have so many problems with this that I find this episode enjoyable to watch, if only to laugh at some of the absurdities and then have fun dissecting it later. Plus, this one storyline you can see on Star Trek and and it's a lot better than some of the other Prime Directive episodes, which is why it gets a 4 out of 5 from me.
Oh.
And actually, once again, I was reading that and I was thinking he or she was going one way, but I thought 4 out of 5 was a perfectly reasonable score.
Yeah.
So thank you once again for commenting. Hey, keep it up.
Yeah.
We are getting to these comments, and I know that we obviously have a bit of a backlog, but we are now doing this regularly again. We always look forward to reading comments.
Yeah, I can't understand why I'm stuttering so much, but it happens. I'm in a hot room. I'm uncomfortable. I got a fan in front of me. I can't turn on because it'll blow on the mic. Oh, what a pain. Okay.
You've been going for 5 hours today.
Right. Yes, we have been recording a long time. Okay, so Carnivore J says, wow, what an episode. I love Data Logan's insights. He truly blows my mind with his considerations all at times. I agree. You know, I tell you, Data has to be pretty damned intelligent. So, overall, I love this episode. I think it deals well with the subject matter, is interestingly done, and that is when I realized that they were hitting a new stride. Data's point about truth not being a bad thing is spot on. But we also have to consider the needs of the planet. Lou's point about killing JFK, I don't necessarily agree with completely, though. Things may have been worse had he lived, but they also may have been better. This is why the timey-wimey episode in Voyager hit so hard. These guys are changing history constantly and trying to find the magic perfect timeline where the bad thing doesn't happen to them. It's awkwardly complicated, but I don't think it's an absolute bad thing to go back and change time. It could very well be, or could make things better. Who knows? That's a good point. And then Data comes through and makes a point I'm trying to make here. Love the idea of the Prime Directive being a coercion clause. Oh, okay.
Yeah, coercion.
Love the idea of the Prime Directive being a non-coercion clause instead of a non-interference. Great stuff there. Troiker? What's a Troiker? Oh!
Riker and Troy. One.
Troiker.
I don't believe it's ever been used before.
Troiker are so
cute. Troiker.
Troiker. Troiker! Troiker. Troiker are so cute together. I created a whole shipper. That's a word my daughter uses. I have no idea what it means. I created a whole shipper universe where they decide to settle down on Mintaka and become part of the culture. Forever wearing their prosthetics and living a happy life making little Mintakan baby prostheses. Yeah, my daughter does that shipper stuff, and I don't know what it means. Do you?
Lou, are you saying you're not down with the kids?
No, I'm not.
I've never heard this word used in this way before.
So it sounds like, you know, if we just... Because the way he says Troiker, I mean, you're merging two people together, shipping them off to their own planet. She can't explain it right for me, so I don't know what shipper means.
No, so I know... So Troika here is just Troy and Riker merged together just because of how certain celebrity couples have that happen to them. But that's as far as I'm going into this sentence. I'm also not down with the kids.
Shipper, a person or company that sends or transport goods by sea, land, or air. I don't think means that. A slang word derived from relationships that generally means people who support certain relationships in fan fiction.
Okay, I see. So, okay, it makes sense now. Don't ask why. I don't want to tell you why, because she's got this thing about the One Direction boys, and I'm not going any further. That motion picture novel is splendid. Everyone should read it, but don't take my word for it. Let's take a look. It's in a book. Ah, Reading Rainbow. Right? Yeah. Data Logan making a subtle pre-seed joke was great. Nitpicks are not my favorite, but for some reason this episode nitpicks weren't exhausting to me. Data, I hope you aren't upset we didn't play your whole... What? Data, I hope you weren't upset we didn't play your whole MP3s on either of our feedbacks. We started a SoundCloud to house all those. We're honestly just trying to find ways to keep our time down since we're some locutus other... Melissa would interrupt him here.
Okay. Locatious.
Locatious? I don't know what that means. Locatious other FU?
All right, I think we're into people from upper pylon to use an app form as the hijack an app form as a communication method to Data Logan.
That's interesting. Okay, but Melissa would interrupt if he starts with an FU, she'd stop him. And we are struggling to keep it under 2.5 hours.
As are we.
Yeah, so are we. We truly do love feedback, and we want everyone to listen at their own leisure. We want to continue to link it. We'll continue to link to it every week. Also, thanks to Lou for the shout-out. We're trying to make it worthwhile, if a bit long-winded, to listen to us. Overall, just a fantastic episode. Love your review, and I give this episode a 4 out of 5 proto-carnivores from the Gilded Age. All right. Well, thanks, carnivore. And you got
he's
it.
He's coming up, isn't he, towards the... I think towards the midpoint of the season, we have him on as a guest.
Yes, a matter of perspective. The Riker's on trial for murder episode.
Oh, yeah. I don't think that's a particularly good one.
No?
But let me... I won't watch it. I won't, I won't bore you. I believe that today his Desert Island Trek landed. So if you've not listened to Carnivore J's Island Trek on 10 Forward, then you can, you know, you'll be able to go back a couple of weeks and it'll be there.
Mm, yeah.
And I believe he was the first to bring on an animated series episode onto his island.
I'm looking up Desert Island Trek now.
One of his top five Star Trek episodes.
Okay, yeah. Chris is Chris Family Johnson's Desert Island Trek. You got it. So he's, I guess he's there. Okay, so I guess that takes us to the end of Who Watches the Watchers, watching the Mentakans. So keep them coming in, and when we do the Vengeance Factor, we will start back up again with the bonding. So we're back on track. All right, guys, thank you very much for listening again, and hopefully, I don't know what made me, it's got me stuttering so much. I'll try and get that Hooked on Phonics book. Maybe that'll work. Good night.
Okay. Good night, everyone.
All right. And now we're going to go...